Today marks 2 years since the death of Jeremy Clarke, one of the most loved columnists in the history of The Spectator. As our former editor Fraser Nelson wrote, for 23 years, his low-life column proved that any life, no matter how humble, can be riveting if the writing is good enough. We have compiled a few of our favourite low-life columns that were read aloud by Jeremy in 2016. Low Life, The Spectator columns of Jeremy Clarke, read by Jeremy Clarke.
Six for Sunday lunch. Me, my boy, my mother, my mother's boyfriend, Dr. Lovepants, my sister, and this poised, well-groomed, long-haired chap, billed as the new man in my sister's life. Me and the boy are a bit late, and everyone else has started eating. The new man in my sister's life's hair is receding at the front and long at the back, and he's got a pointy beard. I'm dying to discomfort him with searching questions. New men in my sister's life as a group are normally among the most unserious people in the world, but this one looks like he's treating the occasion with at least as much earnestness as my sister. The mien is essentially polite. The price tag on the bottle of French wine he's bought says a whopping £7.50. A man of immense intellect and apparently no emotional intelligence whatsoever, Dr. Lovepants has already launched into his customary mealtime monologue. He's a compulsive talker and an ideal candidate, I tell him, for the Compulsive Talkers Self-Help Association, on and on and on. His failing memory means that sometimes we have to listen to a monologue that was broadcast earlier. He and my mother have been visiting National Trust properties in Kent. At Chartwell, they were shown around Churchill's garden studio by an official guide who kindly shared his favourite Churchill anecdote. It was a marvel, frankly, how the guide managed to get a word in edgeways. The story involves the great man himself, Churchill, and a small boy, one of Churchill's grandchildren. Dr. Lovepants acts both parts with a high standard of mimicry that is his main saving grace. Churchill has shut himself away in his studio to study the newspaper. Timid knock on the door. Snort of irritation concedes that the lion's roar is indeed at home. Enter small, timid grandchild. Grandfather, he says, is it true that you are the most famous person in the whole world? Newspaper lowers, revealing face of the old warrior, on which pugnacity is only slightly tempered by kindliness. Yes, now bugger off. We laugh, but all eyes are on the new man in my sister's life to see if he's laughing. He is, but not sycophantically, in spite of our framed portrait of Churchill that he must have seen hanging in the hall. But before anyone can fire off a, so what do you do for a living then, Dr. Lovepants has moved seamlessly on to a description of Down House, former home of Charles Darwin. Seamlessly, I should add, except for the lumps of food that come tumbling out of his mouth every so often. Dr. Lovepants tells us how he and my mother followed the circular garden pathway that Darwin walked every day. Darwin used these walks, said Dr. Lovepants, to give voice to his interior conversation. Does he mean in the same way that he, Dr. Lovepants, uses his visits to articulate his own, I ask him? But he affects not to hear. Maybe in monologue mode, it's only himself he can hear. Throughout the first course, which is roast beef, no one could get a word in. Over the apple crumble, Dr. Lovepants fixes the new man in my sister's life with his eye, and he ratchets up the intellectual ante. His monologue has gone from the garden path at Down House to Darwin's theory of evolution, to the absurdity of creation theory, to Jewish history. And then a flurry of Jewish jokes, the punchline of the last of which has Jehovah tinkling a bell and calling out, two teas please, Mohammed, and then on, via eugenics, to Francis Galton and Oliver Wendell Holmes. Dr. Lovepants leans forward and says to the new man in my sister's life, you've heard of Oliver Wendell Holmes, I take it. We hold our breath. A direct question. The new man in my sister's life is being permitted to speak, to say whether or not he's heard of Oliver Wendell Holmes. Has he, or hasn't he? The way Dr. Lovepants puts it, it sounds crucial in some way. None of us has heard of him, of course, but then none of us has ever heard of anyone outside the Bible or the Premiership. If you ask me, Oliver Wendell Holmes sounds like a housing association. The new man in my sister's life says, do you mean Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes or his son, Judge Oliver Wendell Holmes? He says it with warm familiarity, as if both are personal friends of his. My sister, who only reads menus, looks at the new man in her life with awe and reverence. After lunch, my boy consults his What Car Guide to second-hand car prices and reports that the new man in my sister's life, Mercedes, is worth $4,600 trade and $5,600 to a dealer. Again, impressive. Clearly, this new man in my sister's life is going to be one to watch. I walked into the bar and there was Trev standing in front of a giant screen showing Germany v Italy and chatting up two overawed teenage girls with his usual aplomb and startling frankness. Pleased to see me after all this time, he dismissed them with a kind word and we went to the bar to start drinking. In the referendum, he had voted to leave, he said. Then his cousin Danny came in with Tina, Danny's latest, with whom he is head over heels in love. Danny falling in love with someone has been a big shock to the local community, and it was indeed sad to see him so abjectly enamoured. Since I fell 30 feet off the side of a house and landed on me head, I haven't been the same bloody bloke, Jer, he said Danny, perhaps feeling that I was owed an explanation. And my memory's shocking. I can't remember what happened 2 minutes ago. I asked him if he had voted in the referendum. He had. He had voted to remain, he said. His girlfriend Tina said that her short-term memory was also shot to bits. Tina works in the cafe at Asda, and she was wearing her Asda fleece. She bungs a customer's meal in the microwave, she said, and then she goes away with the fairies and forgets all about it. Yesterday, she had a formal warning from the store manager about her plated nuclear disasters. But her customers rarely complain, and she loves them dearly, and she loves working in the cafe at Asda. Did she vote to stay or leave, I asked her. She said she couldn't remember. She'd gone into the booth with nothing arranged in her mind. She thinks she might have voted to leave. I wandered over to the giant screen to watch the penalty shootout. The misses were farcical. I realised I was watching the shootout with indifference, so I must be quite drunk. At last orders, Trev asked me if I wanted to join him and the usual posse who were going on to a club. They were going to the club that stays open the latest and has the most bouncers on the door. If I perish, I perish, I said. Before we set off, Trev told me all I needed to know about the other half of our clubbing team. Sean was 18, he said, and an unbelievable shagger. Simon, on the other hand, was a virgin. Trev's tone implied no criticism of the latter's virginity, only mild incredulity. He introduced me to Sean and Simon in the taxi queue. Sean was tall and fit and handsome and riding the crest of his monster wave of testosterone. Simon was tall but inarticulate and unconfident, and all that was left for him at 18, it seemed, was absolute humility. Sean had some ready-made MDMA bombs, and he kindly offered me and Trev one each. "Sergeant, take that man's name," said an observant old rocker in the taxi queue behind us. When the taxi finally came, Trev got in the front. I climbed in the back with Sean and Simon. In the darkness, Sean told me, in a deliberate attempt to humiliate, that Simon was a virgin. "Is that so?" I said to Simon, trying to sound like a caring curate. Simon affirmed it, his slight stammer becoming more obvious. I don't want to lose it to the first woman who comes along," he said with forlorn dignity. I want to find someone special and for life. Shagging anything that moves hasn't made you any happier, Sean, has it?" Sean writhed in his seat in a sort of orgasmic delight. "Tonight we're going to find someone to bust your cherry, boy, whether you want it or not," he jeered. From the front seats, tribe elder Trev broke off an intense political discussion with the taxi driver, who had voted to leave, to adjudicate on this. "That's right, Simon Bud," he shouted backwards. "If that's the way you feel, good luck to you, boy. Find yourself someone loyal. You'll be happier in the long run if you do." Once through the scrum of bouncers guarding the nightclub doors, Trev and I carried our drinks to the edge of the lively dance floor to survey ours and Simon's prospects. I've heard it said that the greater the innovation in the observer, the greater the appreciation of a work of art. Enervated by drink though I was, I failed to spot one presentable woman. But where were our young protégés? Sean and Simon hadn't been in the club for more than a minute when they'd been threatened with violence. They decided that discretion was the better part of valour and gone home. By the time Trev raised Sean on his phone and heard all about it, they were at a party back in their hometown. Sent accounts of their worst debacles on drink or drugs. I printed out each one and clipped it into a ring binder. Last Thursday afternoon, I made a pot of tea, opened the file and settled down for a good read. The first sentence of the first entry was, Priggish as it sounds, I'm ashamed of the lesbian orgy I initiated while off my nut on champagne. I read that. It was amazing. Then I took a restoring sip of Rosie Lee and turned the page. The next one was from a soldier. His first sentence was, "Kabul was darker than a Pashtun's fanny." It was a tale of hellish debauchery at a party of South African mercenaries, embassy staff, NGO nymphomaniacs and, quote, bemused translators. After that came a civilian entry, headed by a postal address, the first line of which was, "The Rear Cottage." The opening sentence of the occupant of Rear Cottage was, "I'm in my second day of an amphetamine binge and not yet ready to stop." A decomposing body found in the boot of a car with a crossbow bolt in its head wasn't even the climax of this one. In the next, more violence. I'm transported to Amsterdam's red light district. A punch-up has broken out between a posse of pimps and a party of British lads enjoying a stag night. Our lads are in no condition to sustain the fight and all flee except the narrator, who is too drunk to notice that he's battling the pimps on his own. Then the head pimp, in an unsporting but wholly conclusive manoeuvre, pulls out a small revolver and shoots our tenacious spectator reader in the kneecap. He concludes, unemotionally, that it was a rotten shot, as the pimp's intention had been to shoot him in the groin. There was a fight in the next one, in the toilets of Oil Can Sammy's Bar and Lounge in Grand Prairie, Alberta, Canada. Oil Can Sammy's clientele consists mainly of, quote, drunken Indians, bikers, fugitives, drug pushers, and women of the lowest repute. A fight breaks out in the bar. A biker is using a metal ice bucket as an offensive weapon. The narrator escapes to the lavatory, only to find himself in the middle of another scrap between two other bikers. One is gripping the other's head and smashing it against the automatic hand dryer. It went like this, apparently. Bang! Whirr! Bang! Bang! Slump. Next, another fight in a toilet. We spectator readers do enjoy a fight in a toilet, it seems. This one is between an academic and a janitor at the university staff's Christmas party. The narrator is the academic. He and the janitor are fighting over a woman who teaches chemistry. The lavatory is small. The janitor jumps up on the academic's back. The academic sinks his teeth into the janitor's ear. A peacemaker intervenes and the academic bites him also on the finger. Emerging from the toilet to continue his wooing of the chemistry lecturer, he sees that he no longer has any shirt buttons. He fails to score with the chemistry lecturer or with his first reserve, the college secretary, and he goes home to lick his wounds. By now, I'm reeling a little mentally from all the craziness and the vomiting. Next up is one from a chap who ends his evening at a cocaine whipping party. He's passed out, woken up again, been sick, and now he's been stripped bare, turned over, and is being thrashed with riding crops by three naked women. "Gosh, you can take it hard," says one admiringly. He can barely speak, but manages to stammer out apologetically, "I am afraid I am completely numb. I really am not all that brave." About 3 years ago, there was a launch party for another collection of low-life columns with readers invited. At the end, this tallish bloke with a calm, experienced face came up to me and said, "I've gatecrashed your party, but I do read your column. Now listen, I am real low-life, believe me, and I know that you are only pretending to be one. But good luck anyway," and he solemnly offered me his paw. That guy's kindly admonishment came to mind now. And the terrible possibility again struck me that to most people, my low life seems incredibly tame. Choosing 12 winners was a horrible, impossible task. About 80 out of the 92 deserved to win. I wish now that I had said the first 12 to arrive will be invited or something similar. With a heavy heart, I've chosen 12 winners. They have been invited to Friday's launch party sponsored by Hennessy. Old clothes, I think, for this one.
Last week, in the DAC, I went panting from one Buddhist monastery to another. Culturally, racially, and historically, the DAC is Tibetan, and the type of Buddhism practiced there is Tibetan Buddhism. With a knowledgeable local guide, we visited the great Ladakhi monasteries at Bazgo, Likir, Thiksi, Alchi, and Lamayuru. At each one, we climbed the steps, took off our shoes, and paid our respects in the inner temples. Once our eyes became accustomed to the dark, we examined the carved, gaudily painted statues of Buddhas, deities, personifications, guardian spirits, and whatnot that we found within. The guide conscientiously explained these representations' various functions and positions within the Buddhist cosmology. It was all very fascinating, and I tried hard to commit the essentials to memory. But the complicated iconography strained my powers of comprehension to the absolute limit. The thin air didn't help, and every day I was distracted, perhaps for the same reason, by the insistent promptings of chronic flatulence. There are at least 5 Buddhist denominations, if I might put it like that, which can be divided for simplicity's sake into red hats or yellow hats. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, for example, is a yellow hat. These useful facts I managed to retain. But what interested me more than anything else were the many hideous representations in these temples of malign spirits. Before Buddhism came to Ladakh and Tibet, everybody adhered to the Bon religion, which was essentially devil worship. Later, a Buddhist missionary called Padmasambhava personally subjugated these demons and set them to work in the service of the Buddha. After that, they became known as the guardians of the law. There are 9 principal demons: Yama, Yamantaka, Kubera, Hayagriva, Brahma, Begtse, Mahakali, and Paldun Lamo. Take Paldun Lamo, for example. She killed her son, the story goes, then she skinned him, drank his blood from his skull, ate the flesh, then rode away on a horse using her son's flayed skin as a saddle. Reborn in hell, she stole a sword and a bag of diseases and fought her way back to earth, where the Lord Buddha forgave her and gave her the job of protecting the polity of Tibet. Given Communist China's suppression of Buddhism in Tibet since 1962, Paldun Lamo, I would suggest, seriously needs to have a word with herself and step up to the plate. One afternoon, instead of visiting a monastery, a Buddhist monk came to the house for a cup of tea and a chat. Thupsum Paldun was 73 years old. A monk since the age of 13, Thupsum was sent for training at the famous Drepung Monastery at Lhasa. But the violence attending the Tibetan Rebellion of 1959 forced him and 10,000 other monks to flee the country. He was a rangy, agile, genial man who spoke good English. "You can say anything you like to me, even insult me, but I won't get angry," he promised me, raising his teacup carefully to his lips and slurping his tea. He immediately bridled with indignation, however, when I asked him whether he had attained enlightenment. "Who can say?" he spluttered. "Who can know it, either of himself or others?" Then he calmed down and said quietly, "No, I don't think so, no. It's terribly difficult being a monk. One must study and practice constantly. It's terribly, terribly difficult. You've no idea." I changed the subject. "So what are all these demons?" I said. "The guardians of the law," he said. "They are helpers and protectors." "But they are evil spirits, surely. What place can evil spirits have in Buddhism?" I said. "Evil spirits? I'm not sure that we Buddhists believe in the concept of good and evil. We simply respect all sensual sentient beings, including, if you like, demons. Everything changes. People progress or regress throughout their successive lives. Even the gods fall into bad habits, and the demons, as you call them, can improve." I considered this. I wondered who, for example, the honourable member for Leicester East was in his previous life, and I wondered what he or she had done to deserve such an unusual punishment. Then, conscious of an intolerable tightness around my middle, I raised myself imperceptibly up on one buttock to let out some wind as silently as possible. "But you have no god," I said. If the sound of the tiny outboard motor somewhere was audible to him, the monk gave no sign of having heard it. "Nope, no god," he said placidly. "We know only 4 things. Suffering is truth. The origin of suffering is truth. Cessation of ignorance, hatred, and desire is truth. The path is truth." With his help, I wrote these 4 things down in my notebook, and since that day, I have revisited them from time to time. The first, I totally get. Tick. Maybe the second two, half a tick. The rest, I'm still working on. A new footpath from the village down to the beach opened earlier this year to a great fanfare. It was cut through virgin woodland using JCBs and furnished with stout wooden National Trust gates, fences, and handrails. At one point, the path is lined with gigantic exotic plants, escapees from the lost tropical garden of a long-since-demolished old clifftop house. What they are, I've got no idea, but they are thriving magnificently beneath the shelter of the cliff. "It's like going for a walk in bloody Africa," observed reactionary old grandad to Oscar as we trotted down this path for the first time the other day. One of these triffids was about 7 feet tall, and the tip was bowed over by the weight of its buds. Oscar and I have been playing football every day. We've been working on our heading, as well as the ball, we've been heading anything at or just above head height, including low-hanging apples, naked light bulbs, lampshades, wasps, and small items of clothing hanging on the washing line. Now Oscar invited me to take a running jump and head the drooping tip of this weird plant, which I did, rising like a salmon and connecting with a flick worthy of Alan Gilzean in his pomp. The new path emerged from the woods and joined the old path, originally a coach road, for its final gentle decline down to the beach car park, where my father used to work as a car park attendant. The far end of the beach is a naturist beach by tradition, and many of his regular customers were fanatical nudists. Not once can I remember seeing my father naked. Very rarely was he seen even without a jacket and tie. This buttoned-up man contrasted himself with his freedom-loving customers by wearing his full car park attendant's uniform of peak cap, jacket, epaulets, tie, blue shirt and business shoes, kiwied daily to a mirror gloss, even in the dog days of August. It was partly a joke, I think, and partly dissent. The nudist loved him, showering with small gifts, a chamois car leather, fudge, a breakdown emergency kit, and festive greeting cards at Christmas. Oscar and I passed the concrete plinth of his hut, now occupied by the ticket machine which replaced him. The car park was full, and the hot air shimmered above the tight rows of marks and models whose size and opulence might have surprised him. The beach is vast, and for most of the year more or less deserted, but on August bank holiday it was as crowded as Margate or Blackpool, with gay nudists away at the far end, straight nudists and nudist families in the middle, and on this side of an invisible line were the textiles, which is nudism speak for non-nudists. Oscar and I found ourselves a pitch in the midst of the textile community, close to the waves. We plonked ourselves down, stripped down to our swimming shorts, then played chicken with the thundering surf for half an hour. Then Grandad got knackered, so we went and sat next to our heap of clothes and tossed small pebbles into a discarded polystyrene cup from 3 yards away, competitively. Away up the beach, one could see the wavy mahogany figures of the nudists, many of whom were just standing about, either on the sand or knee-deep in the sea, looking contemplative and philosophical. I've absolutely nothing against nudity. Swimming naked is one of life's pleasures. I walk about the house with nothing on sometimes, but I wouldn't make a song and dance about it. Nor would I drive for hours to a designated plot to be naked, then search for a designated plot within that designated plot. As Oscar and I sat lobbing pebbles, we noticed that a stray nudist was wandering among us, a man aged about 60. He wasn't merely passing through to the public toilets, we noticed. He was striking standing poses, presenting his knob to people, then sitting down and lying down in absurd centrefold poses and caressing and tickling himself. This man, astonishingly, was taunting us for our slavish prudishness. The effrontery was first shocking, then rather admirable. "What's he doing?" said Oscar. He's a retired circus strongman who's lost his clothes," I said, throwing the pebble in my hand at this naked man. It missed, but it was followed by a shower of pebbles thrown by our fellow textiles who were within range, a few of which bounced off his body and close-cropped head. Exit nudist, at the double, pursued by another well-aimed shower of stones. Cheering, laughter, inspired by the summary justice and public stoning. Oscar and I played a new game of tossing pebbles into the air and heading them towards the polystyrene cup. Winston Churchill's secretary, John Colville, recalled that one of the first signs that the great man's phenomenal memory was beginning to fail him and that dementia was setting in was when he made the intriguing faux pas of addressing a man by the name of Mr. Brown John as Mr. Shorthorn. A sure sign that the mental ebb tide is in full flow, of course, is when you can't remember your own name. Nursing homes are packed to the rafters with people who've forgotten what they're called. It's said that US President Ronald Reagan, making a visit with Nancy to a residential home for the elderly, was led up to the oldest resident and, to the woman's obvious delight, embraced her warmly. "Do you know who I am?" said a coquettish Ron, bending over her. "No," said the woman, "but if you ask at reception, I'm sure they'll be able to help you." I once lived in a residential home for the elderly. The title of resident with the least idea of who they are went easily to Jim Elliot, an ex-naval commander who served at the Battle of Jutland. This delightful man had lost his memory and virtually his entire vocabulary, and yet retained the perfect manners of a between-the-wars British naval officer. I've read somewhere that, as it dies, the mind deteriorates in reverse order, with the most recent acquisition of human evolution, language, going first, then reasoning, then the instinct for self-preservation, and so on, until the only thing left is sexuality. Commander Elliot did not conform to this theory. His exquisite good manners were so ingrained that even senile dementia didn't make the slightest inroad into it. I was sitting one sunny afternoon in the conservatory reading the newspaper, half obscured, well, hiding actually, behind some geraniums. Also enjoying the sun that was pouring into the conservatory was Eva, one of our residents, a resolutely working-class Lancashire woman in her early 90s who was nearly blind. In comes the commander, a large man still at 95, spots a lady sitting on her own and pulls up a seat. They sit there, facing the sea, in companionable silence, the commander exuding a kind of humorous gallantry and gentlemanly lack of ego far beyond anything ever preached by a holy man or a Greek philosopher. After a bit, he ventures an amiable comment. "Most extraordinary," he says, raising his walking stick and aiming the rubber tip at the exact centre of a small passing cloud. The natural world intensely interests the commander because his memory was so shot to pieces that at every moment he is seeing everything as if for the first time. Clouds in particular amaze him. No comment from Eva, who hasn't seen a cloud in years. Loath to bore anybody with anything as tedious as his personal enthusiasms, Commander lets the subject drop. His conversational gambit appears to have failed. Eva might be blind, but she's not unsociable. "And who might you be, love?" she says, in spite of them both having inhabited the same house for more than a year. Commander rests his wrists on the handle of his walking stick and thinks long and hard. Nothing doing. He hasn't a clue.
"Do you know? I don't know," he says.
This, from the commander, is verging on the verbose. Usually, his valiant attempts to articulate the words in his mind result only in a strangulated gurgle. The only complete sentence I've heard him utter before this was when I woke him up with a cup of tea on the morning of the Second Gulf War. "Commander, we're at war," I said, placing a cup and saucer beside him.
"Oh, what a nuisance," he said, and giggled.
The commander hauls himself to his feet and totters away. Eva, who is also deaf, opens her watery blue eyes and looks this way and that, like a wary tortoise, trying to discern whether the man who addressed her is still there. After about 5 minutes, Commander hobbles back into the conservatory clutching an envelope. He's made the laborious journey upstairs, located his room, and found an old envelope bearing his name and address. He stands before Eva and presents it to her. She starts with fright. He presses the envelope into her arthritic claw. She hasn't got a hope of reading it, not even if it was the right way up. But she cranes forward and holds the envelope closer and closer to her face until it's pressed right up against her eyelids, and she's wearing it like a mask. "Sorry, love," she says, "I can't read it." Commander tries to say something, but the power of speech has once again deserted him. He resumes his seat and looks out at the sea. I shut my paper and solemnly wonder at the transient nature of empires.